Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good morning, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Karen Philbrick, Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute, a university transportation center. Our mission is to increase mobility for all by improving the safety, efficiency, accessibility, and convenience of our nation's transportation system. Through surface transportation research, technology transfer, education, and workforce development, we help create a connected world. Before I begin my formal comments, I would like to welcome the Mineta Transportation Institute trustees who have joined us today. We have John Flaherty, Senior Fellow from the Silicon Valley American Leadership Forum. We have Rose Gilboa, Board Member for the Peninsula Corridor Joint Powers Board. Bradley Mims, Chief Executive Officer of the Conference of Minority Transportation Officials. Abbas Mahadis, Chief Operating Officer and President of Econa Light Group. Jeff Morales, Managing Principal for InfraStrategies. Dan Smith, President from Capstone Financial Group. And of course, the comments would not be complete without welcoming our Emeritus Executive Director, Rod Diridon. Thank you for being here. Please now make sure that all cell phones, PDAs, and other noise-making devices are turned to silent. Today's program, Paving the Way to a Better Future, the implementation of Senate Bill 1 funds, is sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University. Before we begin, we'd like to tell you about some exciting Commonwealth Club programs that are coming up. This Monday, on June 25th, Max Brooks, that's Mel's son, a fellow at West Point, will be discussing Star Wars and how it explains modern military strategy. On June 28th, we'll have ABC's Spencer Christian in conversation with Dan Ashley, discussing racism, chasing hurricanes, and significant gambling addiction. And finally, on July 9th, we'll have former CIA officer Malcolm Nance offer his take on Russia and its impact on democracy. For more information about club's programs, please visit thecommonwealthclub.org. If you're not yet a member of the Commonwealth Club, today is a great day to join. If you have questions, staff will be on hand to talk with you during the break and after the program concludes. Now on to today's program, which consists of three parts. Lori Berman, Director of Caltrans, the California Department of Transportation, will deliver keynote remarks and take questions during the first hour. Following that presentation, Dr. Asha Weinstein Agrawal, Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute National Transportation Finance Summit, will present the results of the ninth year of a study exploring national support for increasing federal transportation revenues through gas, mileage, and sales taxes. This presentation will be followed by our panel of experts discussing how Senate Bill 1 funds are being implemented and documenting strategies that state, regional, and local governments and transit agencies are taking to address California's transportation needs. As many of you know, Senate Bill 1 provides the first significant, stable, and ongoing increase in state transportation funding in more than two decades. And we look forward to receiving concrete examples of how these funds are being implemented. That was a pun. Concrete examples. So you will find question cards on your seats or in the seats adjacent to you. We'd be pleased to collect your questions, and they will be asked from our moderator of Lori Berman during the Q&A period. During the second half of today's program, we will also collect your questions. And now to begin the broadcast portion of today's program, it's my pleasure to introduce Mineta Transportation Institute trustee John Flaherty, who recently served as Distinguished Service Professor for Carnegie Mellon University. Many of you may know John for his significant contributions when he served as Chief of Staff for the Honorable Norman Y. Mineta when he was Secretary of Transportation. John has been at the intersection of transportation and technology for over three decades, with experience in both the public and private sectors. His tenure in government includes Chief of Staff positions in the executive and legislative branches and for Republicans and Democrats. His private sector experience includes senior positions at well-known Washington, D.C. public affairs firms and in a Wall Street private equity firm. Before moving to California in 2017, John managed a public policy graduate program at Carnegie Mellon University. Now, please join me in welcoming John. Thank you.
Good morning, and welcome on this beautiful day to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm John Flaherty, as Karen said, your moderator for today's program. Today's program is being sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University. Our topic today, the funding of California's transportation infrastructure, impacts every one of us. The need to invest in California's transportation system is dire. And after years of seeking a solution to the state's transportation crisis, the state legislature passed and the governor signed Senate Bill 1, also known as the Road Repair and Accountability Act of 2017. It increases transportation funding by $54 billion over a decade. SB 1 provides the first significant, stable, and ongoing increase in state transportation funding in more than two decades. Estimates are there is nearly a $140 billion backlog in deferred maintenance on our highways, bridges, local streets, and roads. While the funding crisis is widely recognized, solutions are difficult to come by. Today, we will look at various strategies that state, local, and regional governments, as well as transportation agencies, are taking to address our transportation needs. MTI will also present the results from the ninth year of a national opinion poll on various tax options for raising federal revenues for transportation. To address this subject and its related issues, I'm pleased to present Lori Berman, the director of the California Department of Transportation, also known as Caltrans. Director Berman is actively engaged in the implementation of SB 1, the Road Repair and Accountability Act, and Caltrans' efforts to deliver SB 1 projects and rebuild California. Since she started at Caltrans in 1983, Director Berman has held several positions, including Acting Chief, Deputy Director, San Diego and Imperial County District Director, and Senior Transportation Engineer. As a side note, it is important to add that in 1983, when Director Berman graduated as a civil engineer, less than 7% of the civil engineer graduates were women. Director Berman has long been an integral part of a statewide leadership team here in California. She shares the vision for a future state transportation system infused with innovation and new technologies that will provide truly multimodal options to efficiently move people and goods across California. Please join me in welcoming Director Lori Berman.
Thank you. Good morning. I am really tremendously honored to be here and looking forward to sharing some thoughts with all of you. First, I want to thank the Mineta Transportation Institute for its research, education, technology, and workforce development programs. First, I'll tell you a little bit more about me. I am the new Caltrans director, but I'm not new to the department. I started at Caltrans 35 years ago as a junior civil engineer after graduating from Michigan State University. And I worked in various divisions and locations around the state. And then 24 years ago, I was fortunate to move to San Diego to head up the seismic retrofit design for that region. And when that was complete, I spent what felt like a lifetime, but was really only about a dozen years working with our private sector partners to deliver the state's first P3 or public-private partnership project, the South Bay Expressway, also known as the 125 South Project. The last 8 years, I was the district director in San Diego and Imperial Counties, where I worked closely with our partners, both local government and environmental resource agencies, to build big and complex projects, which none of us could deliver if we were just working on our own. I also had the entire California-Mexico border in the district, and that required partnerships with local, state, and federal government agencies in Mexico, which was a very unique and enjoyable part of my job. Now, today, I want to tell you about some of the work we've done in San Diego to give you a sense of where the department as a whole is going, and then I'll spend the bulk of the time discussing the state of and the demands being made on our aging transportation system, and share with you why I believe SB1 funding is absolutely critical to California's future. As an advocate for innovation and technology, I am proud that San Diego was one of two sites in the nation to develop and operate an Integrated Corridor Management System, or ICM. We worked in partnership with local agencies to reduce corridor congestion by managing city streets and highways as a single unified network rather than as individual networks. So if there's a slowdown on one part of the corridor, travelers are diverted to another. If there's an incident on the freeway, travelers are diverted to surface streets. This has helped us to build a unified transportation system to improve mobility and maximize system efficiency and reliability. I'm also really proud of the work that Caltrans has done on the I-5 San Diego North Coast Corridor project, which broke ground last year, and that will improve all modes of transportation and enhance the environment on 27 miles of highway that connects the cities in the northern part of San Diego County. I-5 is one of the most traveled highways in the nation and connects to the national highway system linking to Canada and Mexico. In San Diego, it also connects locals and visitors to six lagoons, to world-renowned beaches, to employment centers, including the high-tech and highly congested area known as the Golden Triangle or Sereno Valley, as well as the University of California at San Diego and Camp Pendleton, both of which are huge job centers. And the I-5 connects many communities as well. And this corridor is emblematic of our entire system. It was opened in the late 1960s, and we just have not made the appropriate investments since then. However, as the population has grown, the congestion on I-5 is predictable, only in that the travel times are always unpredictable. Uniquely, the congestion on the weekends is even worse than on weekdays. And this project, which we built as an entire corridor, demonstrates how multiple benefits can be achieved when you take a holistic approach to managing a transportation corridor, which includes all modes as well as environmental mitigation. So this project, which started as an idea to add some carpool lanes and maybe a general purpose lane, has become a project which serves better bike and pedestrian access to the coastline. We are double tracking several segments of rail to improve those times on the coaster. We're adding carpool lanes, and most notably, we were able to improve the health of the lagoons, which allowed us to obtain a coastal permit for the entire 27-mile corridor. And having worked at Caltrans for a long time, I don't usually tell people we did more than mitigation. We are actually improving the health of the lagoon. Also on this project and several others, we were able to tap into SANDAG, the San Diego Association of Governments, their advanced mitigation program. And that combines environmental mitigation for multiple projects. This has saved us time, resources, and money. And the idea of an advanced mitigation program is now included in SB1 to allow the state to realize these same efficiencies. So that's a little bit about what we've done in San Diego. Now I want to talk about transportation, the state of transportation. We can all agree that our state's transportation system is a critical asset that drives jobs, trade, and enhanced competitiveness. Californians drive more than 350 billion miles a year, more than any other state, and our transportation serves a $2.2 trillion economy, an economy that is now the fifth largest in the world. But did you know that most of our transportation system was built in the 1950s and 60s when California's population was just 10 million? Now our population is nearly 40 million and is projected to be 50 million by 2050. All of these people are relying on us to maintain the more than half a century old system so they can go about their business, taking their kids to school, driving to work, getting to the doctor's office, and delivering goods to market. The transportation policy, decisions, and improvements we're making today will affect them now and well into the future. And we know there will be more people and more trucks on the roads in the not-too-distant future. In 2015, nearly $2 trillion worth of goods traveled on California's roads. What's impressive is that our more than half a century old system supports 40% of our nation's imports. In 2045, the worth of goods on California roads is expected to double to $4 trillion. Think about what the roads will be like then if we don't do anything now. The consequences of not properly investing in our transportation infrastructure are real and serious. It's going to mean slower production and delivery of goods, more congestion, more impatient drivers. It will put the brakes on our mobility and degrade our economic competitiveness as a state. Fortunately, in 2017, Governor Brown signed Senate Bill 1, the Road Repair and Accountability Act, to restore the purchasing power of the gas tax and provide a more stable source of transportation funding with strong accountability measures. Before passage, the state gas tax hadn't been raised or adjusted for inflation since 1994. Now, just to jog your memory, in 1994, it cost $4 for a movie ticket, and rent in a lot of places, I don't know about the Bay Area, was about $530 a month. So imagine trying to pay your bills today with what you were earning nearly 25 years ago. Before SB 1 passed, California state highways and local roads faced $137 billion in deferred maintenance needs over the next decade. SB 1 will generate $54 billion over the next 10 years to be split between the state and our local partners, and this revenue is necessary to bring our roads, bridges, and critical infrastructure up to today's standards. These transportation dollars double the money available for state highways and local roads and add substantial new funding for transit and intercity passenger rail. It also prioritizes funding for easing congestion along state highways and supporting our freight economy by investing in key infrastructure improvements. The bulk of our efforts are dedicated to the state's most pressing transportation challenges, fixing roads, bridges, and drainage systems and traffic management devices to reduce congestion. Caltrans is committed to fixing more than 17,000 lane miles of pavement, 500 bridges, 55,000 culverts, and 7,700 traffic operating systems such as ramp meters, traffic cameras, and electronic highway message boards. SB1 also established strong performance measures to gauge our progress and created oversight and financial accountability. New revenue generated under the Road Repair and Accountability Act are dedicated for transportation use only. The taxes generated from fuel were already protected, and earlier this month, voters approved Prop 69, ensuring new vehicle registration fees would also be used for transportation only. To ensure SB1 funds are spent properly, Governor Brown appointed an inspector general over SB1 funds, and the California Transportation Commission has additional oversight over how that money is spent. SB1 provides drivers with many benefits at a relatively small cost. The Department of Finance estimates that each motorist will pay about an additional $10 a month due to SB1. This funding will give Caltrans and local communities an opportunity to catch up on years of unfunded maintenance and work to keep highways and local roads in a state of good repair. All this work is going to improve our economy and our quality of life. At Caltrans, we have been hard at work since SB1 was passed, starting and finishing several projects that were originally planned for years down the line. So far, we have started and completed work on nearly 20 projects, awarded or started construction on more than 100 projects, while also expediting the design and environmental work on nearly 200 additional projects. SB1 is making a difference in your community and many more across the state. In May, we finished a $1.7 million project to resurface 7 miles of I-5 between 605 and Washington Boulevard in the Los Angeles area. We also started a $55 million project in May to replace 104 lane miles of I-880 pavement from north of Fremont Boulevard overcrossing to High Street in Alameda County. This month, right here in San Francisco, we have an $800,000 bridge project, which will revamp 4 bridges on U.S. Highway 101. In our more rural counties, we will begin a $14 million project this July to repave 90 miles of I-5 from the Glen to Hama County line to Red Bluff. We are also widening traditional highway striping statewide from 4 inches to 6 inches for greater visibility. And that's going to be done on State Route 99, Highway 101, I-5, 10, 15, and 80. And as I said, that will improve the visibility and the safety for the traveling public. We are on target to complete all the striping projects by March of 2019. While there is a good deal of construction going on now, many of the projects benefiting from SB1 are major maintenance projects, and those can take years of design, study, and planning. One of our challenges is to assure the public that the work to develop projects is happening now, even though they don't see it out on the roadway. So that's why the state created the SB1 website, rebuildingca.ca.gov, so the public can see what we're doing with their tax dollars. There's an interactive map if you want to see what's happening in your community. SB1's scope, however, is larger than just our highway maintenance projects. Over the next 10 years, SB1 will modernize local transit, improve trade corridors, reduce congestion, and fund badly needed highway, bridge, and drainage repairs. Just last month, the California Transportation Commission allocated $2.7 billion for three new programs, the Trade Corridor Enhancement Program, the competitive portion of the Local Partnership Matching Program, and the Congested Corridors Program. That's a lot of programs. What these projects are going to do is tackle congestion, support our valuable trade corridors, and bolster local agency efforts to invest in their transportation infrastructure. And we'll see these projects come to fruition as we move forward. SB1 also requires us to pursue innovation and technological advances across all modes of transportation along the system. It allows state and local transportation agencies to create a modern, equitable system that includes safe pedestrian crossings, bike routes, and transit elements that provide access to all users of all ages and abilities. SB1 is an economic driver. These projects create jobs and show strong investments in our communities. Rebuilding California plans for a better tomorrow, making our streets, highways, bikeways, sidewalks, and public transportation safer, more reliable, and more sustainable in the long run. With all this investment comes added work, and in the coming years, Caltrans will hire new workers to help deliver projects and also help offset a retiring workforce. Caltrans is doing a lot of hiring. In addition to Caltrans hiring, we are also looking to meet our workload need with a diverse group of contractors. We are increasing our outreach efforts to help small businesses and minority and veteran-owned businesses make connections and contract with the state. Caltrans has a big job and limited resources, so we are constantly looking for ways to connect, work smarter, and manage our assets. And that is important given the vast system we manage. Caltrans manages more than 50,000 lane miles of roadways, inspects nearly 1,000 airports and aviation facilities, maintains more than 200,000 culverts, ensures the safety of over 26,000 bridges, and funds the largest state-supported passenger rail system in the nation. To help us with all this, Caltrans has recently developed and published California's first Transportation Asset Management Plan, or TAMP. The California TAMP was the first in the nation to be federally certified, which is a huge accomplishment, and it was a huge undertaking, and now we're getting calls from all over the country asking for help. The plan developed a performance-driven approach to select and fund projects and maintain state highway system assets. It establishes a framework for performance-driven investments with clear targets and transparent presentation of today's system condition. This plan is helping us prioritize projects that meet multiple performance measures. This reduces traveler impacts since we don't have to come back to fix another part of the system in the same corridor. So we're prioritizing updating multiple system elements at each project location. The plan also moves decision-making to our local Caltrans district and gives funding flexibility to collaborate with our local transportation partners on multi-agency projects using SB1 and other tax measure funding. This is changing the way Caltrans does business to be more accountable to performance measures, improving the effectiveness of projects, maximizing efficiency, and improving transparency. Each of our 12 regional or district offices now has a portfolio of projects planned for the next 10 years to define a clear path toward meeting the goals of SB1. We want to maximize our resources to efficiently manage the second largest state highway system in the nation because the work we do, along with our partners, helps support and drive the world's fifth largest economy while making California a great place to work, live, and play. In addition, we are looking for efficiencies in all areas. We are using innovative contracting tools, streamlining environmental reviews, and using new technology to manage our system and do our jobs more efficiently. Our mandate under SB 1 is to save $100 million each year and to put that money back into maintenance. Our goal is to save and reinvest even more money than mandated. Now, as it turns out historically, Caltrans has implemented cost-saving measures pretty regularly, but we never shared that information outside the department. So I am pleased that SB 1 requires us to first find $100 million annually in cost-saving measures and also to share that information with the public. As we do this, we know it is important to share our successes with the public so they understand the benefits of what they're paying for and see how it is improving their local roads. They need to know that without SB 1 revenues, these improvement projects will be downsized, delayed, or deleted altogether. And it is critical for the public to understand that we have prioritized our maintenance of the system over the years to fix the areas in the worst condition first. Without SB 1, there is no other added funding for us to draw from. So without SB 1, the projects we are talking about are impacted. In turn, the reliability of the system will be impacted. I can't overemphasize the importance of California's transportation system in supporting our economy and quality of life, and how essential SB 1 is to our continued prosperity. As we put SB 1 dollars to work, we will need to plan for the future and balance the needs of the present. As we plan for the future, we must also be cognizant of the impacts of climate change on our infrastructure. We continually see the impacts on our transportation facilities from fires, droughts, and floods. We only have to look at the 12-day closure of Highway 101 in Montecito this past January to consider some of the newer stresses on the system. This also highlights what happens when we don't have a reliable system. We have issues in some parts of the coastline where erosion of the roadway is a significant and growing problem. Historic rains in early 2017 caused $1.2 billion in damages to our state's infrastructure, closing 44 roadways at one point, including State Route 1, where two slides isolated the Big Sur area from the rest of the state for 8 months. We are planning to reopen Highway 1 south of Big Sur in late July after reconstructing the highway over 15 new acres of coastline that was created by the Mud Creek slide last year. So to begin to understand and manage climate change, we are developing vulnerability assessments for each region of the state. We've already completed the first assessment for the San Francisco Bay Area. As our climate change vulnerability assessments illustrate, our world is changing and we need to be ready for sea level rise, larger winter storms, more frequent wildfires, and increasing temperatures. Sustainability is critical. A resilient and integrated transportation system not only offers accessibility and mobility choices, but improves state and local prosperity. As we look ahead, we also need to balance transit, cars, pedestrians, bicycles, and trucks, as well as the rapid advancements in technology, materials, sustainability, and communication. New technology, innovations, and partnerships will be critical as we put SB 1 funds into action to improve our quality of life, the environment, and the economy. So let's work together to do all we can to ensure that the path we forge today is one that truly advances transportation and mobility to create something better for Californians. So I want to close by saying most of you don't know me, and I've really appreciated your attention while I have discussed a lot of the things that I am most passionate about regarding the state's transportation system. I am also very passionate about safety, the safety of the traveling public and the safety of our workers. Safety is personal to me and the top priority for the department. There are a lot of people working on California's roads and highways right now, working hard to catch up and fix years of unfunded maintenance projects. These people all have families that they're trying to get home to at night. So as you drive through a work zone, and you're going to be seeing a lot more of them, please slow down and be work zone alert. When you see the flashing amber lights, please move over a lane if you can, or slow down as you drive through that work zone, and let's make sure everybody gets where they need to be at the end of the day. Thank you for your attention.
It's now time for our question period, and we have a number of questions from the audience here. So let's begin. The first question is, what kind of oversight does Senate Bill 1 have, and can funds be used for non-transportation purposes?
Okay, so funds cannot be used for non-transportation purposes, and that was a really important element, and I think a lot of people still have this idea that in Sacramento the funds can be taken away. They can't, and that was part of what Prop 69 assures. The other part of that question was oversight.
Yeah, what kind of oversight does it
so have? SB1 has an inspector general who was appointed earlier this year, Irena Ortega, and she and her team are responsible for taking a look at our programs under SB1 and making sure we are set up properly to capture all costs, and she's doing a great job helping us make sure that we're set up properly, and I welcome that extra attention.
You're the first director who's ever said, I welcome that extra attention from an IG.
Well, let me explain that. I was taught earlier in my career when I was working on the P3 project to never be afraid to invite audits in at the beginning to make sure that you're set up properly. I don't want to go down the road and find out that we're not capturing our costs appropriately. So I do welcome that, and she and I work really well together. So I think it's going to be very good for Caltrans to have somebody from outside the department taking a look at what we're doing.
Excellent. Second question. Much of SB1's investments seem to flow toward repair or rebuilding. What measures does the bill have to maintain satisfactory road conditions rather than simply fix a continually occurring problem? And a follow-up to that is, will Caltrans be able to achieve 98% or what percent of can they achieve of highways in good or fair condition?
Great question. So I was district director for 8 years, and one of my biggest frustrations has been that we didn't have the funding for a proactive maintenance program, and so it frequently felt like we were just kind of holding the system together as best we could. We just didn't have the funding to do the work that we knew would really repair the problem. And I know that the general public probably experienced that as well. And so with SB1, we can go out and actually do the real fix that needs to be done. And that's why some of these projects are going to take a little longer to get out to the field, because we're not just doing what feels like the Band-Aid approach. We're actually doing the design. We're getting our environmental permits, and we're doing the bigger fix. So that's a really important part of SB1. And SB1, while it has several other programs in it, the bulk of the funding is for what we call the fix it first. And because for a long time we've continued to build out the system without appropriately investing in the maintenance. So SB1 is really going to force us and help us to appropriately invest in the maintenance of the system. And again, not just the state highway system, but also local roads as well.
And it's important, I think, to discuss for a second that SB1, we call it Senate Bill 1, but it is a law passed by the legislature.
Yes.
Currently.
Yes.
And you folks are moving forward on it now. There's a political effort to repeal the law, but the reality is that the law exists. You guys and Caltrans is moving forward on it currently, correct?
Absolutely, we are. As soon as it passed, and then we started receiving money in November, I think. And we started moving ahead. There has been a huge need. We were able to really push ourselves to accelerate a lot of projects into future years, into the 17-18 fiscal year, so we can get that work out on the street. SB1, as you said, is the law, and the money's coming in, and we need to go ahead and take advantage of that and do the work that Caltrans does, which is repairing our roads.
We're in the Bay Area in Silicon Valley. We have a number of questions from the audience with respect to transportation and technology. So let me start by asking, what new technology is the state looking at to improve our highway system? For example, will electronic tolling be coming to other bridges?
So electronic tolling is used in some parts of the state. I'm not sure how soon that will be coming here to the Bay Area.
And what other technologies will you be looking at? For example, how do you see public transportation and driverless vehicles and issues like that?
Sure. So the driverless vehicle question, of course, is a good one, especially here. We actually, in California, we have USDOT dedicated to 10 autonomous vehicle proving grounds in the country. Two are here in California, one here in the Bay Area, and one actually in Chula Vista in San Diego County. And so we are working with the private sector on these are proving grounds that they can try out their ideas on. So there's a lot that we're doing through that and through our research group. And then we also work with TRB, Transportation Research Board, with ITS America, to stay current. And I would also note that the autonomous vehicle regulations are being handled through DMV, but we're working with them.
We have two questions with respect to moving goods and freight, and specifically what can be done, or looking into the future, do you see freight being moved off of commercial vehicles onto the rail system?
So that comes up a lot. At this point, we don't see a lot of, there hasn't been enough investment in freight to make that a reality.
One of our audience says, after a recent trip to Japan, I couldn't help but feel that they are living in a transit future that we are struggling to achieve. But they've had high-speed rail for near 60 years or 6 years. What proactive measures are being taken to expand high-speed rail and at a lower cost?
I don't know that that's a good question for me. But ultimately, you know, we are working to integrate all modes of transportation in the state. So the rail plan, the state's rail plan includes high-speed rail, and I think high-speed rail is obviously a really important component of what the future of transportation looks like in the state of California.
A couple of questions on resilience and planning. Given the stated need for long-term planning, especially in acknowledgement that you mentioned of climate stresses, what is Caltrans planning for adoption and resilience? Any percentage of SB1 funding dedicated to that? And specifically, what are we doing with respect to the impact of earthquakes and evacuation routes and other catastrophic events?
Sure. So, Caltrans, let me start with the last part of the question. And with regard to earthquakes and evacuation routes, specifically evacuation routes, we work with local first responders and law enforcement. And in the fires that we just had last fall, we work on making sure that there are evacuation routes. And we do all kinds of planning with locals to be sure that that can happen, that that's not an issue. And I think that we do really well with that. With regard to earthquakes, we have historically done really well in terms of seismic safety, obviously in this area. You know all about that. And we need to stay on top of that. We have not had a significant earthquake in California in a long time, and we need to be sure that we continue to be ready for that. And I actually met with the Seismic Advisory Board earlier this week, and we had that discussion. So I think that's a really important thing for us to stay on top of. In terms of resiliency, SB1 funds aren't specifically set aside. We don't think of resiliency as a separate thing. We are incorporating that into the design and planning of all of our projects. We're accounting for sea level rise in a way that we didn't previously. And we're also looking at, as we see the erosion of the coastline, it would be foolish for us to continue to build in the same place. So and it's going to be costly to move some of these routes, but it doesn't make sense to keep fighting Mother Nature. So I think that was all the questions on that.
Yes. California residents and their lawmakers have taken a step forward to pay for this, but Senate bill funding is state funding, which introduces the question of federal funding. And specifically, what do you think of the current administration's plan to expand and improve infrastructure? Is it adequate? And do you foresee some federal funding coming California's way?
So, you know, in terms of transportation funding, we never have enough. We will continue to figure out how to use our state dollars to leverage federal dollars. We continue to compete, and usually successfully, in the federal grant programs. And we'll see as we go along how the federal transportation funding package comes forward. We're very engaged in conversations about the federal funding programs.
You've been in Caltrans for a number of years. I want to return back to this question of how do you see, in terms of past administrations and this administration, is this a tougher challenge for states to with respect to the infrastructure plan, and or are there going to be opportunities in the future?
I think there will be opportunity. I'm hopeful there will be opportunities in the future. And you're talking about the federal
funding.
You know, we haven't had a strong revenue stream either on the federal or state side in a long time. So I mean, At some point, we need to recognize the investment that needs to be made in our system to keep it competitive and reliable. So I remain hopeful.
Good. A reminder to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of the California Radio Program. Our guest is Lori Berman, Director of the California Department of Transportation, who is discussing the implementation of Senate Bill 1 funds. You can also find a video of Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. There was one question. We had a question about oversight. We had a question from the audience with respect to management. Although the top Caltrans leadership seems to get it, middle managers often continue to plow ahead with some questionable projects. Will you take the lead to stop these projects, even if they have been fully approved? And I've edited some of that language.
Okay. So that's a really interesting question. I'm going to give you the long answer. Over the last 8 or 9 years, we have significantly changed course at Caltrans, and I'm really proud of the work that we've done because it shows that you can change course in such a large organization. That being said, we continue to change how we're doing business. I mentioned our transportation asset management program, which is a 10-year portfolio of projects, which is designed and vetted so that we will move the needle on the condition of our system and all elements within the system. So we have the portfolio of projects that's out there. We will be looking at those quarterly to get started. So it's very transparent what we're working on. Mid-level management doesn't actually make different decisions than what the department makes. We are working with our partners on appropriate projects. And I think, and those are all come through the Transportation Commission. So all those projects are vetted out. I don't think you'll see too many projects that somebody, it sounds like somebody just decided we don't work that way. So I'm confused by the question, but hopefully my explanation allays your concerns that something different is happening.
Okay. Is the transportation crisis simply predicated on a lack of funding, or are there other factors that hinder the improvements in California transportation?
I think it's really a question of funding. I think it's a question of we just have not made the appropriate investments. I always liken it to buying a house and then feeling like you spent a lot of money to buy it, so you're not going to maintain it. And then you wonder why it's falling apart. So we have an opportunity now to fix our house and make our system reliable. And if we continue to watch it fall apart, we're going to have more situations where we have to close down roads, or we are not addressing seismic safety and we have to close bridges. And those are really real concerns that we have going forward.
This is a question. I know that you're, as the director of Caltrans, you're focused on the transportation, but there's a bit of a political element here with the effort to repeal SB1, and much of it is led by the new gubernatorial nominee, John Cox, who's currently running for governor. He wants to stop SB1. We have a question from the audience that says, what has the dialogue been between Democrats and Republicans with respect to transportation funding? And either during the campaign or after the campaign, do you see that dialogue improving at all?
I think because Caltrans is a large organization, it's kind of an easy punching bag. I don't see the dialogue really changing. It's strange because historically, you know, transportation was something we could all agree was an important investment, and it's disconcerting to see that now that is not viewed as an important investment either.
Right. If SB1 is repealed, do we lose our ability for self-help and for federal funds, or what are some of the implications if it's repealed?
Well, that's a good question. If SB1 is repealed, the state funds will be diminished. Self-help funds will still be there. And certainly, depending on the federal program and how much it leverages state dollars, we're not getting a tremendous amount of federal dollars like we used to. So I wouldn't count on federal funds solving that problem.
And you said that transportation used to be a, if not a nonpartisan, a bipartisan issue.
Yeah.
We have a question from the audience that says, how can we convince drivers that they should or have to pay for their roads? Or will the cancellation of SB1 affect gas tax increases, et cetera?
Well, and I think that's the question is, how do we help people understand what their taxes are paying for, that these roads don't repair themselves. It costs money. We have to hire people to do the work. It's a huge undertaking. And I think generally, and I do over my 35-year career, a lot of interaction with the public. But the public, and myself included, we want to go about our daily business and not be impacted so much by people want to get where they're going in a timely manner. And as long as that's happening, I don't think people are giving much thought to how much are they paying for the gas tax.
We're talking about motorized travel, but won't this conflict with the objectives of AB 32 to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Sure. So we're also working to reduce greenhouse gas emissions through a lot of the materials that we use in our construction. And Caltrans also is working with other state agencies to improve zero-emission vehicles and accessibility to zero-emission vehicles. So we are working to put more electric chargers in public places, and so that we can have more zero-emission vehicles and continue to reduce greenhouse gases. So I don't cancel
each other.
You
don't see
them
in conflict.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier in your remarks that you want to maximize resources. And you also mentioned that you were a leader in one of the first, public-private partnership here in California. Mm-hmm. And yet, the investment by the private sector in P3s, in genuine P3s, has been relatively minuscule, particularly here in California. Can you talk to that? And why do you think that's happened in the past? And do you see it improving at all in the future?
So I do see it improving in the future, although right now we don't have authority for P3s in transportation in California. I think the first P3 we did in California through the AB 680 program was it was the first in the country, and it threw all the risk on the private sector and cost them quite a bit more than they expected. And I think we learned a lot from that, and I think we continue to learn from what other states are doing. But I also think that there's this idea that P3s will solve all of our financial problems, and they won't. There are appropriate projects for P3 investment, and there are a lot of projects that really don't work with P3 investment, and you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis and really look at lessons learned from other states.
Well, can you talk a little bit about that? Because, again, California you currently don't have the authority for
Correct.
Public-private partnerships, and yet a number of other states have, in some significant projects, leveraged private financing, and in a way that doesn't necessarily abdicate the authority of the public entity. So can you talk a little bit about California? One of the criticisms has been that the Caltrans engineering unions have gotten in the way of private investment coming in and have inhibited that in a way that it hasn't occurred in other states.
Okay. I'll just use the 125, for example, and that was also the first design build we had in our district in San Diego. And I think a lot of the risk was, in fact, all of the risk was put on the public sector. They had to go get the environmental document complete, which was, as it turned out, was not a good risk to put in the private sector for a couple of reasons. So that was one of our first lesson learned, and I always have to say that doesn't hold true across every project, but it was a significant issue because the environmental document took probably 10 years, and that was not something they had planned on. And every hurdle it could hit, it hit and got delayed and delayed, but they continued to fund the development of the environmental document. When that road, there was a design build. A lot of people, I know I've heard all the stories about the engineers union stopping things. The individual engineers that work for us are not listening to their union to tell them to slow down projects or anything. So the policy side, that's a bigger issue. But once the project is in Caltrans, we move forward. So we did move forward. The way that project was set up was a little bit funny. In terms of the coordination between the designer and contractor on the design-build side. That's like a whole other story. When we broke ground on that project, Chula Vista, where the project was the fifth fastest-growing city in the country. When we opened the project, it was one of the cities that was hardest hit with foreclosures. So it opened at the wrong time. There's a free choice. People had another option, and so they weren't spending their money on tolls. I just actually recently spoke in D.C. about the long lesson learned, and ultimately the developer went bankrupt, filed for bankruptcy. Sandag bought that, and it's now a part of the regional transportation system, and they lowered the tolls. I think that if they had opened and it wasn't the first day of the recession, they would have had more luck. And I think if they had had enough money to look at a longer-term picture, we would have come out of the recession and they would have started to make money again. But so those are some reasons why that project, some say didn't work. I say it worked as it was supposed to. The risk stayed where it was supposed to. These are complicated questions, and I think there's certainly room for P3s. But I want to really caution that it's a lot of people feel that's the panacea for lack of transportation funding, and it is not.
Right. Thank you. We've had a couple of questions. I want to combine them into how is Caltrans preparing for the uncertainty and unprecedented rapid rate of change and disruption in transportation?
That's a great question, and it is really hard to manage today's system and be ready for tomorrow's system. So what we are doing is we're trying not to preclude things. So, for instance, I mentioned the wider striping that will last longer also and be more visible at night. So that's helping today's system, but it's also going to be helping tomorrow's system when autonomous vehicles can read those lane lines. So we're doing things like that. We're coordinating with other states and with the private sector. Originally, I think we had discussions with some of the autonomous vehicle companies about what did they need from us, and they said, we're good. And then as we started talking, we opened up that discussion. But the challenge for us, and there's more innovation than just with autonomous vehicles. There's a lot of innovation with vehicle-to-infrastructure communication, vehicle-to-vehicle communication. We are using some of these things for to do demonstrations of truck platooning, which will allow trucks to drive more closely together, that will increase capacity. So we are looking at different things and how it impacts our road. And I think the best thing for us to be doing is to continue to stay engaged with the research so that we're not precluding what we do. What we do today does not preclude tomorrow's innovation.
In 2018, if Lori Berman was just starting out now as a civil engineer in Caltrans, when she reaches the directorship, what sort of technologies do you think will be here at that point that are not here today? What do you think? Where do you think this is headed in terms of, as one person says, the convergence and disruption of the transportation systems?
That is a great question. So look at, eventually we're going to have more autonomous vehicles. I think it's going to take longer to turn over the entire fleet than we think, but it's going to mean that we're safer, in our vehicles or whatever mode we're in. And it's going to mean that the people out repairing the roads, because those roads are always going to need to be repaired, they're going to be a lot safer. Hopefully we will figure out how to manage the additional cars, which was going to create additional VMT or vehicle miles traveled, and figure out how we manage that. There's just a lot of exciting things going forward that I think it's a great time to be entering the transportation field. When I started at Caltrans, we were at the beginning of the seismic retrofit program. And so right now to be thinking about what your career at Caltrans could be like will be very exciting.
Talk a little bit about, you mentioned vehicle miles traveled there, as opposed to going up and filling up your tank and paying for what the hose says. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
You believe we're moving toward that. People are struggling with that, both from a policy viewpoint as well as an operational viewpoint. And it sounded like you thought it was inevitable. How do you see that unfolding?
So I meant a different thing by vehicle miles traveled, but what you're talking about is the road charge.
Road charge,
which also refers to vehicle miles traveled. So Caltrans is one of several states that is looking at a road charge pilot, and that measures because, well, the gas tax is great as our cars become more fuel efficient, and that's been part of our problem. It's just not generate because the gas tax is a per gallon tax. So we're looking at a road charge that measures vehicle miles traveled. Did anybody participate in that pilot? Okay, a few of you. Good. It was really simple. For me, I snapped a picture of my odometer, I think, every quarter and sent it in, and they captured that information. There was different ways to capture that information. So we're working primarily with the Western states, but we also have nationwide partnerships to look at how to make this work. And there's a lot of considerations. For instance, we want to be sure that if you have a lot of property that we're not capturing miles traveled on your private property, how do we assess that as you travel into other states or living in San Diego, when you travel into Mexico, how do we make sure we're not capturing that? Those were important components of the first part of the pilot. Now we've recently received a federal grant to look at how would a pay at the pump type collection system work. Oregon looked at this several years ago. We have more information since then. So we're looking at it so that we have more answers and we can define a program that we think would work. We're not there yet. It's going to require a lot more. And that's another thing that people would have to get used to. I know I am charged by my car insurance company by the number of miles I travel, and I send them a picture of my odometer twice a year also. So it's not an unheard of thing.
I want to say we have a couple of technology questions. Do you think that Caltrans will be involved in aviation in the sense that people will be moving vehicles to the air, you know, and along the drones? Back to the young Director Berman starting out. Do you think that's going to happen in the next 25 years?
You know, I've always wanted that jetpack that would take me in the air. So I don't know that we're going to have, I mean, we're working on a drone policy, and I think drones will help us tremendously in terms of cost savings at Caltrans. Just especially like you think about after an earthquake or after a significant event, we want to be able to get, if we can get up in the air and see what's actually happening, that'll be helpful for some of our bridge inspections, to be able to take a drone under the bridge and look at what's going on. That'll certainly be much cheaper. So I think drone technology is here. I think there's a tremendous number of uses for it, and we're looking at that. In terms of individual air travel, you know, I can't predict that. That's an interesting one.
Okay. Well, we'll return to the ground with this question from the audience, which is a much more operational and practical question. How is your agency coordinating with local agencies to keep places like I-280, US 101, freeway traffic out of the southeast San Francisco neighborhood roads that were never designed to handle freeway volumes or speeds? And this introduces the question of, with the new technologies of Waze and Google Maps and others, there are alternative routes that are bringing traffic into roads that were not designed necessarily for that sort of traffic volume. What do you see in terms of the future of that?
So that's a really good question. And there's certainly been a lot of the technology has been disruptive in different kinds of ways. And certainly Waze is putting traffic where it was not really intended. We work with Waze to communicate changes in our system. If we're going to have several lanes closed or a full freeway closure, we'll work with Waze to alert people that they can't take that route. In terms of what it's doing to neighborhoods, Caltrans is not involved in that, but I do know different locales have different ways of making sure it's only local traffic is on their road.
Transportation projects, the criticism of transportation projects are how long they take, and that a need exists. Everyone agrees on what the solution is and what the project should be. And then for a variety of reasons, including permitting, including the opportunity for local groups and for other groups to get involved and to one side would say interfere, the other side would say have their concerns adequately represented. The result, nevertheless, is an extended line or downrange completion time. What is Caltrans doing to address those things?
So projects do take a long time to develop. The environmental process is, it's set up to protect communities and to protect the environment, and that's what it does. And it requires a lot of coordination with communities and a lot of looking at the impacts that we're creating. And I don't think that's I agree with the frustration about how long it takes, but I don't think it's a bad thing to force ourselves or to be forced to study the impacts to the environment. I think there are some things that I'm looking to improve in terms of how long it takes to get permitting. We had a lot of success with the Coastal Commission and staff on the I-5 project that I mentioned earlier. And I think there are certain things that there was a bill that was passed last year that requires Caltrans and local, and resource agencies, state environmental resource agencies, to work together on streamlining. We're doing that. I think we're all very excited about how we can come together and solve those problems. I've told my staff, we've talked about this for a long time, that, environmental resource agencies don't have the same mission as Caltrans. Caltrans does not have the same mission as these resource agencies, but we should be able to come together and figure out how we all get what we need and do it in a timely manner. I think the advanced mitigation program that I mentioned also is going to be helpful in getting jobs permitted more quickly. And then I wanted to also mention the time it takes to actually build the project. It's really hard to build projects without disrupting the general public. A lot of our work is done at night. That's a little scary, but a lot of it is done at night. But that gives us really short work windows because we don't set up, depending on the area, we don't start setting up our, and I know this is very engineering-ish, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
Please do.
We don't set up our lane closures till around 9 at night, and depending on the size of the job, it may take a few hours to get it set up. And then we've got to start picking up early because generally we want the lanes reopened by about 5 in the morning. So you think about, it's just not enough time to really get the work done. So one thing we've had success with, and I know you've had this here in the Bay Area and as well as other parts of the state, is what we call the super closures, where for a weekend we say, just stay away, we're going to get a lot of work done. And those work really well. They're not for every project, but those work extremely well. We inconvenience you once for a whole weekend, and then we're done. And during that time, we also take the opportunity to get other maintenance work done in the area at the same time. So we keep trying to figure out how to get jobs done and not inconvenience the people we're serving.
We have a question from the audience with respect to, are you looking at the issues that are going to happen with respect to large future events such as the 2026 World Cup and the 2028 Los Angeles Summer Olympics? And that introduces high-speed rail and some of the things you're doing in transportation planning. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Yeah, we are working with locals on, they're working with us, we're all working together on these major events. Those are like extreme major events. We have other events in each part of the state where we work with our local partners to be sure that we can accommodate things. So that planning is going on.
There's a question from our audience with respect to self-help agencies. What do you think about county transportation self-help agencies? Aren't they assuming the functions traditionally done by you at Caltrans? And don't they cause piecemeal parochial planning instead of regional or statewide focus? And are you holding them accountable, or can they be held accountable?
Okay, so my experience with self-help counties is in San Diego with SANDAG, but I'm certainly familiar with the others and getting to know the other self-help counties better. I think these partnerships are critical to getting work done. And in fact, in San Diego, we put project teams together that include SANDAG employees and Caltrans employees, and our goal is that our employees no longer think about who they are working for. They think about the project they get to build. And the value of these partnerships is that there's some things that SANDAG can do that, or other self-help counties can do that Caltrans can't do, resources they bring that we don't have. There's expertise that we bring that the self-help counties may not have. And working together, we get really big things done. One thing that has been also very successful for us is that we don't think about if it's them or it's us. It's about who are we serving, what project are we trying to build, and how do we work together to get it done. So I look forward to working more closely with the self-help counties and the rest of California, because I've had such great experience working with the one in San Diego.
We have a question raising the issue of technology companies here in the Bay Area, and that Facebook, Oracle, Salesforce, several other technology companies are involved with transportation issues in a number of ways. Are you interacting with them or interfacing with them in an effort to improve congestion and to impact transportation planning? And if so, how?
So some, and I'm sorry, I can't, probably somebody here knows which company it is actually has actually put money into some projects. And yeah, locally, the local district I know is working with several companies too. And we're always working with different companies to help improve transportation in their area, because it's really, I mean, part of our job is helping you get your employees to work every day.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. And we had a couple of questions with respect to safety, and you discussed in your comments, your remarks, the importance of safety along with transportation efficiency. And I know that you personally feel very strongly about the safety of your transportation and Caltrain workers. So given my recent return to California, I have to notice that the on the highways, cars have picked up their speeds and have picked up their lane changes from back when I was growing up here. And those were the days of the $500 rents that you were talking about. Can you talk a little bit again about the safety of transportation workers and the need to keep Caltrain workers safe?
Yes. Unfortunately, we have not had a year go by that we have not lost at least one Caltrans employee. And just last week in L.A., we lost a contractor's employee who was hit by a truck. It's hard to work right next to those orange cones and have live traffic speeding by you very quickly. There's no room for error. I always tell my maintenance employees I can sit in my office and make mistakes, and I can recover from those mistakes. They don't have that luxury to recover from those mistakes. And so we are always trying to remind people, please don't drive drunk, first of all, and that's what concerns me when we have people out working at night. But there's so many distracted people, and you can see them. You can see the cars slow down, and as you drive by them, you see that they're on their phone or they're texting. You can't be paying attention to where you're going if you're on your phone or texting, and so that's why we say it's very simple. When you see the flashing amber lights, you see the cones, when you're driving through a work zone, just slow down and pay attention, because it's not just my workers. A lot of people are killed in work zone accidents or injured in work zone accidents because they weren't paying attention. Things change quickly when we're out there on the road. The configuration one day may not be the same as it is the next day. And I want to mention the safety of the traveling public also. I get notifications of every fatality on the system. There's just too many. We need to pay attention to what we're doing.
Well, our thanks to Lori Berman, the director of the California Department of Transportation. This program has been sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University. Thank you to our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. We also want to remind everyone that following the conclusion of this portion of the program, our panel discussion will take place following a 5-minute recess. So, Director Berman, thank you again for an excellent presentation. I have listened to the Commonwealth discussions. You got through a lot of questions for a guest, and we really appreciate that.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Welcome back. We're now pleased to begin the next portion of today's program. First, we will hear from Dr. Asha Weinstein Agarwal, who will summarize results from the ninth year of an annual survey project exploring national support for raising federal transportation revenues through gas, mileage, and sales tax. After her presentation, we will hear from our esteemed panelists, Roger Dickinson, Executive Director of Transportation California, Mike Hirsch, General Manager of AC Transit, Michael Quigley, Executive Director of the California Alliance for Jobs, Phil Washington, CEO of LA Metro, and Carl Guardino, CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. As a reminder, we will be pleased to collect your written questions during this portion of today's program. Thank you once again to our keynote speaker, Director Lori Berman. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker. Please note that in the programs, you'll find more complete bios for each of the people who will address you today. Dr. Asha Weinstein Agarwal is director of the Mineta Transportation Institute, National Transportation Finance Center. She is also a professor in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at San Jose State University. Her research is focused on finance, pedestrian and bicycle issues, and transportation history. Asha, please join me to share the results of Year 9 survey. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. And I am delighted to be here today to, for the very first time, share the results of a survey that, as Karen mentioned, is about transportation taxes and fees. And we're just releasing it today, so you're the first to hear. This poll is the ninth in an annual series that we've now been doing where we assess public opinion about different options for raising new federal revenues, thank you, in particular with a focus on either raising gas tax rates or introducing new mileage fees. And I'd like to acknowledge, is Hillary Nixon here, my co-author? No, okay, I'm just going to have her wave at you all. She's my partner in crime, and also I very much want to thank the Mineta Transportation Institute, which has funded our survey year after year. Now, it's conventional wisdom that Americans hate taxes, and in particular the tax that we have traditionally used to fund a great deal of our street and highway infrastructure, which is the gas tax. But, and here in California, I think right now, as was alluded to in our earlier presentation, that's particularly on people's mind because we just raised our gas tax rates through Senate Bill 1, but at the same time, we now have a recall effort happening. So, is it true that Americans hate the gas tax? We hear that all the time, certainly at professional conferences. You'll hear a lot of hand-wringing over that. But I would argue that this conventional wisdom is perhaps limited and that the general public may not actually be as opposed to certain kinds of increases in our transportation revenue and sources. So that's what I'm here to talk about. Now, this year's poll, which again is one in a series, was a random digit dial survey of Americans. So that's when the telephone rings irritatingly during dinner or maybe when you're taking a nap on Sunday afternoon and somebody asks for a few minutes of your time. And we reach out to both cell phones and landlines and we do our survey in English and Spanish. And so we end up with a pretty good representative sample of American public opinion. And we mostly ask about people's opinions about different options for raising the federal gas tax rate, as well as two different options for introducing a brand new mileage fee. And we also have a sales tax question thrown in there just kind of for comparative purposes. We have asked with identical language these questions year after year so that we can really do, have confidence in our trend analysis to see has public opinion changed over time. Now, one last thing before I get to the actual findings, which is that I want to stress that what's valuable, I think what we in the room can really take away from the study results, is not the exact support level I find for any particular tax that we ask about in the project, because support for a tax is going to depend enormously on the context in which it's asked about and the exact details of how it's structured. But what I think our survey project does really well and that has sort of lasting and long-term value for anyone considering a tax increase, is looking at how the public responds, the relative support for different options for raising transportation revenues. And clearly, you'll see some options are much more popular than others. And it's that difference, that relative support, that I think is really the important lessons we can take from this project. Let me start. We asked, as I mentioned, about a variety of different versions of raising the federal gas tax, all of which would equate to a 10-cent per gallon increase in the rate. And when we asked about sort of the most generic, plain version of this, where we just told people we're going to raise, you know, the gas tax rate 10 cents per gallon for transportation, doesn't say anything more than that. Well, not very popular. We had 34% of people saying that they would support that kind of plain increase in the gas tax for transportation. And a similar thing happened when we asked about a new mileage fee. We told people that this would be a penny per mile assessed on all their travel, and that the money would be used kind of generically for transportation. And this was even less popular than the gas tax. Only 27% of people said that they would support that idea. And these numbers are the kind of things you often kind of hear people wringing their hands about, if you believe we need to fund our transportation infrastructure, and they get cited. But those low numbers are really not the end of the story. They're just one piece of the story. So in our polling year after year, we've discovered that every variation on those two plain, what I'll call base case tax options, gets considerably higher support. So let me show you what I mean. So that mileage tax, plain one, 27% of people said they would support it. We also asked about what I'm calling a green mileage tax. And here we told people that the average rate everybody pays would be a penny per mile, but that the specific rate would vary according to the vehicle's pollution level. So more polluting vehicles would pay a higher rate, less polluting vehicles would pay a lower rate. When we asked about this green version of the mileage tax, we got 46% of people saying that they would support it. That's a whole lot more people than the 27% who said that they would support the plain version. And again, what I think is meaningful here is these difference in different variations on a tax idea. And a similar pattern holds for the gas tax. When we asked, what about that 10-cent per gallon increase in the federal gas tax, but where we phase in the increase 2 cents per year over 5 years? Support went up to 54%. That's a 20 percentage point increase in support for essentially the same tax, but structured a little bit differently. And to give another example here, we also asked people, well, what about that 10 cent per gallon increase in the federal gas tax? But we're going to dedicate the revenues to maintenance and preservation of the transportation system. When we asked that way, we had 72% of respondents saying that they would support that idea. That's almost three quarters of our respondents, and you know, pretty. Not only is it it's well over a super majority, which in California is very important because a lot of our local taxes have required 2/3 of voters or a super majority to support these local gas tax options. And again, that 72 percentage points, that's 38 percentage points higher than the 34% of people who said that they would support kind of the generic for transportation gas tax increase. Now, in addition to looking at what our overall set of respondents, reflective of the full American population, might think about transportation taxes and fees, we also looked at some subgroups, for example, men versus women, or people who drive a lot versus people who don't drive at all. And we ended up with 300 plus of these groups where you're comparing people. And a key thing we found is that there's usually not that much difference. So, for example, any group you look at, much higher support for the maintenance gas tax than the plain base case one. So this is not something that just holds for certain parts of the population. And at the same time, there were a few groups that did stand out as particularly supportive in general of these taxes, like strikingly more than a comparison group. And these groups were Asian and Asian Americans, as opposed to respondents who were identified as white, people who identified with the Democratic Party, not a big surprise, as opposed to Republicans, people who place a high priority on having government improve safety, as opposed to people who don't prioritize that, and people who place a high priority on improving and expanding transit service. So let me now lastly turn to trends over time. So again, we've been doing the survey for 9 years now with identical questions, keeping, you know, the methodology consistent. And when we compare this year's results to the previous 8 years, there are a couple of simple messages that I take away from it. First, support for the taxes is pretty similar year to year. You know, it'll bump up and down a little bit, but there's, you know, not usually a huge change. But if we look at support in 2010 and we compare that to support today, there has been a modest but noticeable increase kind of across the board, with one exception for the taxes. So in general, we have seen support rise 10 or 15 percentage points across the different taxes in that period. The one exception to this is the flat rate mileage fee. People didn't really like it in 2010, and they still don't particularly like it in 2018. So just to wrap up, I would conclude that our survey results suggest that transportation tax increases can be acceptable to the public. It depends on the circumstances. And we can really probably dramatically increase support for the idea of raising new revenues if we carefully think about how we structure the tax and explain it to the public. And one of the key things that we're able to see from our survey work is that it really matters what you spend the money on. And you don't have to list projects necessarily, but you need to give people categories of improvements that they care about, that they value. And we have found that three specific purposes that seem to be quite popular with the public are using the revenue for a better environment, for better safety, and in particular, for better maintenance of our transportation system. So for those of you who are interested, we do have some little one-page research briefs lying around or at the back. And MTI also has all of its research up on the web for free PDF downloads. And so I invite you to go look at all the detailed tables there if the details interest you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Asha. And I'm sure the report will be a fascinating read. It's now my pleasure to introduce our panelist. Joining me is Roger Dickinson, Executive Director of Transportation California. Thank you, Roger. Roger was with the law firm of Greenberg Troag as a member of the Government Law and Policy Practice Group. Prior to that, he represented the 7th Assembly District, including the cities of Sacramento and West Sacramento. Roger established himself as a very effective lawmaker, having 42 bills that he authored signed into law. We appreciate you being here today. We have Mike Hirsch, General Manager of AC Transit. He was appointed General Manager in 2015, and he is a 9-year veteran of the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority, where he served as Deputy Director of Maintenance and Security and Chief Operations Officer. He's past chair of the California Transit Association Rail Operations and Regulatory Committee. Thank you for joining us. We have Michael Quigley, Executive Director of the California Alliance for Jobs. Michael has spent his career advocating for infrastructure and transportation development. And since joining the Alliance in 2008, he has helped secure billions of investment dollars toward public works and infrastructure projects. Welcome, Michael. We have Phil Washington, CEO of the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transportation Authority, better known as LA Metro. Originally from the south side of Chicago and a 24-year veteran of the U.S. Army as Command Sergeant Major, thank you for your service, Phil. He now leads LA Metro's program. He's responsible for an annual operating budget of $1.6 billion and for overseeing $15 billion in capital projects. Finally, our final panelist of the day is Carl Guardino, president of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, a public policy trade association that represents nearly 400 of the Silicon Valley's most respected employers. Appointed to the California Transportation Commission by two governors, he recently led a 3-year campaign for Measure B on the November 2016 ballot. It passed with a supermajority and will yield an additional $6.5 billion in local funds for traffic relief solutions. Carl is named one of the 5 most powerful people in Silicon Valley, and it's our pleasure to have him as a panelist today. So I suggest that you look for additional details in our program should you wish to learn more about their backgrounds. But in the event of time, let's get started. Roger, may we hear from you about the implementation of Senate Bill 1 from your position as Executive Director.
Sure. Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to join you, and thanks to the Institute for the invitation to be here on just a gorgeous Bay Area morning. And I have to say that if you have a small measure of any doubt about climate change occurring, waking up in San Francisco in a June morning with no fog ought to convince you that climate change is absolutely real. Transportation California is a statewide coalition of organizations, associations, and companies representing both management and labor, which advocates for more state funding for transportation and on other transportation policy issues. Will Kempton, who perhaps most of you even in the room know, was my predecessor, as well as a legend in transportation circles. But as I told Will when I succeeded him, I'm both taller and better looking. Well, taller anyway. Transportation California was intimately engaged in the long-running legislative efforts that resulted in SB 1, and since it was signed into law, we have been focused on both its implementation and its defense. But before we talk about those activities, and I appreciate especially the remarks of Director Berman about what Caltrans is doing with respect to implementation of SB 1, I'd like to set that stage a little bit for you beyond what she shared. For example, as many of you know, California currently has a population of about 40 million people, but that is projected to increase to 44 million by 2020. And now we have risen to the level of the fifth, perhaps even the fourth largest economy in the world. We also in California are proud of the fact that we enjoy an unparalleled quality of life. And yet, when it comes to transportation, we have fallen woefully behind. We are 48th in the nation regarding the condition of our highways. We are in a position where 58% of our roadways need repair or rehabilitation. 87% of our counties have an average pavement rating of at risk or poor. We have 6 of the nation's 10 worst urban area pavement conditions. 26% of our bridges need major maintenance or preventive work or even complete replacement. We collectively lose nearly 94 million hours a year sitting in traffic. And 14 of the nation's most congested corridors are right here in the Golden State. 66% of our major urban highways are congested. 46% of our transit buses, we've got agencies here that are on the streets every day getting people where they need to go, but 46% of our transit buses are beyond the recommended 12-year replacement age. And over $37 billion is needed for transit capital investment alone over the next 10 years to bring it to a state of good repair. Before SB 1, this hole would only have gotten deeper. The last time the gas tax was raised, as was mentioned earlier, was 1994, and due to inflation and increased fuel efficiency, the buying power of the money that comes in today is about one half of what it was in 1994. However, thanks to SB 1, we have an ongoing and sustained base of new revenue projected at about $5.2 billion a year. And we talk about this in terms of what it'll generate over 10 years, but it doesn't end at 10 years. There's no sunset on SB 1. As most of you may know, it goes on. We know that this money is also dedicated, as mentioned before, and is limited to transportation projects and programs by the state constitution, augmented by the passage of Prop 69 earlier this month. But we all know the challenge. An initiative paid for by partisan interests for partisan purposes that poses a severe threat to this vital funding stream. So for Transportation California, our job is twofold. First, we must make sure that as many projects to provide immediate improvement to our streets, highways, bridges, and transit systems are undertaken and completed. Doing so will be the best demonstration to voters that their money is being spent as intended. Transportation California is working with all our partners to facilitate such projects. Second, we must make sure that voters know that if the initiative passes, 5,000 projects, many of which are getting underway this year, to fix streets, repair bridges, and improve transit service all over California go away and won't be done, impairing public safety, hurting our economy, and damaging our environment. I'm sure Michael Quigley is going to have much more to say about that when he speaks as well. Transportation California will continue in concert with the Coalition to Protect Local Transportation Improvements, or CPLTI, just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Our efforts to educate the public regarding what is at risk. As an example, in May, we had this insert included in the Sacramento Bee to inform the public about what was happening in the Sacramento region. We also joined with the California Transit Association and the California Alliance for Jobs to commission a study by the American Road and Transportation Builders Association that shows SB1 over the next 10 years will generate about $183 billion for the California economy and 68,000 jobs on an annual basis, along with clean air and other environmental benefits. This is a copy of the study, but if you're interested in seeing the entire study, it's available on our website at transportationca.com. You can also get a host of other useful information on the website mentioned. I want to repeat it, that Director Berman mentioned it, rebuildingca.ca.gov, which includes an interactive map of the projects all over the state. We'll be engaging in more educational efforts around the state using a variety of media as we head into the fall. But much more than is usually the case with a statewide initiative, this campaign must have a local approach in each community. I urge each of you to make sure your family, friends, neighbors, colleagues, associates, employees, anyone you encounter knows what is at risk. Guaranteed funding for over 5,000 transportation projects that will increase public safety, drive our economy, benefit our environment, create new jobs, and improve our quality of life. This is truly a fight we can't afford to lose. Thanks very much.
You can stay there.
I'm going to go ahead and hide behind that podium.
Mike, General Manager.
Big guys like hiding behind podiums, so I don't know how well this is going to work here, but I'm most comfortable. Dr. Philbrick asked for some concrete examples of SB1. Bus agencies don't have a lot of concrete, but I am going to give you some actual what SB1 is doing today. Before I do that, I want to thank Mineta Transportation Institution and the Commonwealth Club, because this is frankly the number one issue facing public transit today. It's certainly a very critical issue facing AC Transit. Before I do that, I just want to remind everybody, sometimes AC Transit, I think, is in the shadows. We're the third largest transportation or transit agency in the Bay Area, third largest bus only in the United States. We carry over 170,000 people a day. I'm not here to try to recruit you on to public transit, but I am here to explain, even if you're not a public transit user, the benefit. We carry 14,000 people a day into this city or on our Transbay service. Some of that's to Palo Alto and the peninsula. But can you imagine if 14,000 people were in automobiles instead of buses? We're extremely excited to be moving into the Salesforce Transit Center. We expect that Transbay service to increase. But candidly, I need to give you an update on the state of public transit. We could operate more service today if there was more funding. When SB1 passed, everybody said, oh, yay, no new money. What are you going to do with it? Well, it wasn't new money for us. It was a lifeline. Public transit in the United States, with the exception of Seattle, we are all facing declines in ridership. Some agencies are facing double-digit declines in ridership. We're fortunate at AC Transit, largely because of voter support, both sales tax and parcel tax. Our ridership is basically flat. But without, and understand, SB1 dollars are flowing today. One of the concrete examples is that SB1 has money for operations. We would have had over a $3 million deficit this year if it was not for SB1. We currently have, and understand this, 45% of my over 2,000 employees are retirement eligible. We have a hiring freeze, a travel freeze, freeze on non-safety critical training, because if SB1 goes away, when you're a bus-only agency, the only place you can make reductions is in service. 170,000 people a day. Over 80% of our trips are work or school related. Over 70% of our riding public lives at or below the United States poverty level. Remember, this is the Road Repair and Accountability Act. As was said earlier, it's a law. Our buses are on those congested roads. Our buses suffer from those, no offense, from those road conditions. We need to do a better job of explaining to the public the price of auto ownership is not what you pay at the gas pump. I think a lot of auto owners today forget about insurance, maintenance costs, and those roads are causing vehicles to wear at a much faster rate. As was already said, many of the buses in the state of California are past their usable life. We have 650 buses. The average age is over 7 years. We have a significant number of buses that are over 14 years. SB1 dollars will be used to replace buses that are beyond their useful life. But it'll be done in a clean way. We are extremely proud to be the operator of the largest zero-emission hydrogen fuel cell fleet in the United States. In the world, Director Peoples reminds me, one of my board members, we are adding over 10 hydrogen fuel cell buses in the next, again, SB1, in the next few months, concrete. We are adding battery electric buses to our zero emission fleet. And we were successful in receiving a 29 combination of two grants, $29 million, a portion of which is from SB1, because we developed a plan to deploy zero emission buses in disadvantaged communities and areas where non-attainment has not met. We will have the cleanest buses running in the communities that most desperately need zero emission, clean public transportation. That happens because of SB1. Again, we're that sometimes overlooked public transit network on the other side of the bridge. We connect to 20, I describe us as the web that connects every other agency together. We connect to 25 BART stations, 6 Amtrak Capital Corridor stations, 3 ferry terminals, and 16 other public and private transportation systems. We love BART. We love Grace Krenikin. But we all know that BART is extremely overcrowded, particularly in the peak. We could add service today if we could purchase buses and had operating dollars for those buses. For us, $12.7 million a year is SB1 directly to our operating budget. If that goes away, that's a $12.7 million service reduction. I appreciate the opportunity to be up here. Again, I really appreciate Mineta for shining the light on this so important topic. Please, we want to evangelize you. Go out in your communities. This is about pothole repair. It's about reducing traffic, which gets our public transportation systems more reliable, more on time. Again, even if you're not a public transit rider, you benefit from the improvements in our road networks, and you benefit both economically and in your personal life from a strong public transportation system. Thank you.
Thank you so kindly for picking up on my pun and sharing those concrete examples. As a federally and state-funded university transportation center, it's important to note that we can't lobby and we can't advocate, but we can certainly educate, and that's the purpose of today's program. With that said, may I now invite Michael Quigley up, Executive Director for the California Alliance for Jobs. Let's hear about the workforce impact. Thank you.
The Alliance for Jobs is a labor management organization that was founded over 20 years ago by both the management and the union leadership of California's heavy construction industry. And today we represent over 2,500 contractors and over 80,000 union construction workers who build and maintain our state's infrastructure. And the Alliance was founded with the mandate to work with both the political structure, but also communicate the benefits of transportation to the voters of this state. And over the last 20 years, we've been very successful at a local level, communicating the campaigns that were needed to create the local pots of money through our self-help county programs. You know, now we have over 24 counties representing about 80% of the population of the state, including some of our more conservative counties like Orange County, that have had the opportunity and have successfully passed with a two-thirds measure a local transportation option. And that is something that I think we should all think about as those forces who are moving forward with repeal, is that this state is a pro-transportation state. As what polling we just heard about earlier that matches with other public polls and some of our internal polling, there is an overwhelming desire from the voters of California to see improved transportation options, an improved transportation system, and they're willing to pay for that if they feel that the money is going to its appropriate designation. And as we move forward in, with this fall, and we're in this now hyper-partisan frame about what gas tax repeal is, who's behind it, and what this is going to mean for the future of the state, I think it's important that we focus back on what the benefits are, both to the network, but to the individual motorist. And we'll talk a little bit about that here during my presentation. You know, $26 billion of this $52 billion pot over 10 years is going directly to local communities. You know, that's for your own streets and roads, you know, your own your neighborhoods. And this money will be spent in every community, every county. It will literally be a transformative project. It will transform the way we deliver projects across the state. And you see here with Director Berman and others, we are gearing up and scaling up to really make a major change in how California's transportation system works. However, there are those who oppose this. And so the Alliance has been leading the charge to really structure a campaign and structure a message and really structure a future for California where we can deliver these projects and don't move backwards. $15 billion is going to fix it first highway repairs. You know, $4 billion over 10 years is going to be just for bridge and culvert repairs. That's going to repair over 500 bridges in this state. You know, $3 billion for trade corridor improvements, $2.5 billion to reduce congestion, $1.4 billion for interregional highway and intercity rail. This is going to touch every aspect of our transportation system. And the economic benefits are clear. You know, the Roger mentioned the study that we had worked on together along with the Transit Association. You know, that this SB1 is directly going to create over 68,000 jobs annually across the state. And 28,000 of those jobs are in direct highway, bridge, and street construction. You know, another 21,000 in the transit sector and over 18,000 in the design, engineering, and right-of-way. So, and that doesn't even include the induced economic activity, which you can look at in our study. We actually went and analyzed what these transportation investments will mean outside of the construction and engineering sector and looked at 19 different economic sectors, everything from agriculture and mining to tourism. And so this will have a ripple effect across our economy, you know, really unlike anything we've seen because it is a permanent program. This $183 billion in economic activity in driver benefits is going to mean the repair and repaving of over 84,000 lane miles over the next 10 years. Replacement to 556 state and local bridges in the first 5 years. And importantly to this overall discussion as well, California drivers will save over $800 million in operating costs on their vehicles because of improved roadways. You know, so when the opponents of repeal are, well, that's us, when the proponents of repeal are pushing this narrative about the costs, they are ignoring the benefit, both the financial benefit, the benefit to motorist quality of life. And so that's ultimately what's going to be up to our campaign, is to communicate, is that this is a transformational project. These projects are transformational to your actual community where you live. You will see the benefit. And what's going to happen, I think, over the course of this year is that voters are going to figure out what's really happening, who's behind this, what they want to accomplish, and what they stand to benefit. And they're going to make a decision about, is it worth 12 cents a gallon? And I think most of them are going to side with us. You know, we had the opportunity to pass Prop 69 in the June ballot with almost 81% of the voters' support. You know, that's just how intense the voters feel about dedicating money towards transportation, getting that money where it's intended to go so they can feel the benefits. And now here we are on the SB1 repeal. You know, the repeal folks have submitted over 900,000 signatures. They need 580,000 valid signatures to qualify, and we expect that to happen. Could actually happen before the end of the day today, if not, very likely on Monday. So this fight is on our hands, and it's going to be up to us to ultimately win and fight this. You know, the folks who are funding the repeal effort, I think it's important that we let people know about that information as well. The California Republican Party contributed $375,000. John Cox himself has contributed $250,000. Paul Ryan, Steve Scalise, Kevin McCarthy, Mimi Walters, and other congressional Republicans have put in about $750,000. And then there's another $400,000 from out-of-state interests that showed up to qualify a repeal of California's gas tax. There's a real estate developer in Michigan who gave $100,000 to this effort. What does he care? And that just shows you what's the real motivation behind this. And this has nothing to do with supporting California's future. It has actually everything to do with protecting a handful of Republican congressional seats. And that's why this question is before us today. You know, we have a very difficult task in front of us with this campaign. But what polling is showing us, as we've heard today, and we've heard in the past, and we'll hear again in the future, is that voters want to see solutions. They need to know that the accountability and the transparency is there for their revenues, that they're coming out of pocket to generate, and that money directly translates into transportation benefits and options for them in their communities. You know, we're going to have to do a very broad and coordinated effort, but will ultimately be many sub-region campaigns rather than one singular statewide message. This repeal fight will be fought in every community. It will be fought on a regional basis with regional messengers talking about regional benefits. So some of the folks here in this room, you know, expect to be getting a phone call at some point, you know, before November. We're going to need folks like you who are intelligent, informed transportation professionals to be able to go out in your own communities and communicate to both your neighbors, but also your broader political establishment. Because even within the Bay Area here, there are folks who believe that repeal is the correct course of action. And we think that with the three themes of letting folks know what the benefits are, letting folks know what the benefits are and what transportation accountability and protections have been in place now through Prop 69 and other previous ballot measures. And finally, the third piece of information is that who's behind this and what they hope to accomplish by repealing our gas tax. And when voters learn these facts, they're not going to support the repeal, folks. And I think it's up to us to ultimately communicate that. But I feel confident that come November, California will move forward with transformational road improvements, transit projects, and bridge safety upgrades that will make ultimately a better future for all of us. So thank you.
We will look forward to hearing more how we can help the effort during the question and answer period. Phil Washington, Command Sergeant Major, please, may we hear from you next. Thank you. CEO of LA Metro.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me here. Yes, the fight is on. The fight is on, and it's a real battle to Save SB1. And I've got my war clothes on, but we have to make sure that we do not lose this battle. LA Metro, as you may know, we move about 1.3 million people a day on buses and trains, and we are also doing highway improvements. You know that LA Metro is the largest county in America with over 10 million people. And we went to the ballot in 2016 and asked LA County voters there to invest in infrastructure. And they did. They said yes, to the tune of about 71% of the voters there said, yes, we will support this measure. And we were bold enough to ask them to support a measure with no sunset, where that particular investment continues unless voters decide to end it. Very, very bold to do that, but I say that and I mention that because at the local level, folks understand the value of infrastructure investment. They understand that value. And in 2016 and also last year, of all the local measures in the country, 70%, over 70% of those measures were successful. Now, that tells you something that folks, again, at the local level, understand the value of infrastructure investment. That measure was called Measure M. Down in LA County, allowing us to implement 18 mega projects in the first 15 years, 40 mega projects in the first 40 years, thousands and thousands of jobs that are being created. And within that Measure M, we also adopted what we call 28 by 2028. This is an ambitious effort to complete 28 projects by 2028. That's 10 years. And 2028 happens to be the year of the Olympics as well. And so the idea to complete 28 projects in 10 years, I believe I can say that that within Measure M is the most ambitious endeavor in this country, and we're looking to do that. And SB1 will provide the assistance for us to accelerate those projects. It's already doing that. In this first tranche of funds, it is helping us accelerate a rail connection to LAX. It is helping us with a rail line called the West Santa Ana branch that will come up from the southeast part of Los Angeles all the way up to downtown through some of the most impoverished zip codes and neighborhoods in LA County, providing local hire arrangements to allow for people in those disadvantaged communities to help build their own communities in terms of job creation. It will allow us to improve our Orange Line BRT. And so it's a whole list of projects that SB1 is helping us with, to include first and last mile. We are looking at what we call microtransit to allow for smaller vehicles to do curb-to-curb Uber and Lyft-like services. We are on the cutting edge of doing projects like microtransit to get people around and to address this first last mile issue. We're looking at our entire bus system at LA Metro in an effort called NextGen to wipe the slate clean of routes and look at new employment centers, look at new residential areas to determine whether we should have new routes going to new residential and employment centers. We are really thinking about how we can speed up that bus system. One of the surveys that we did recently And the results of that survey that we got back said that the number one initiative that we need to do in L.A. County is speed up the bus system. Because people, I mean, right now on our local bus routes, our speed is like 9 miles an hour on average. On the express routes, it's 11 miles an hour. This is crazy. We need to speed up the bus system. We have initiatives in order to do that. So we're excited about SB1. We're excited about carrying the battle and fighting to make sure that people understand the value and the benefit of these investments. We are communicating through PSAs. We are treating this like the campaign that Measure M actually was as well. So I look forward to your questions. I'm happy to be here, and thank you for having us.
All right, last but not least, CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, Carl Guardino.
What an honor it is to be back at the Commonwealth Club. My wife Leslie and I recently celebrated our 15th wedding anniversary on May 10, and to underscore the generous and romantic man that I am, I took her away for 15 hours to celebrate.
Yay!
Yes, and we're still married. That was because we were in the final sprint of 74 straight days to co-run a 9-county Bay Area traffic relief campaign known as Regional Measure 3, which our visionary voters in the 9-county Bay Area passed last week, 2 weeks ago on June 5th, by 55.2% of the vote. So why do I mention the wedding anniversary other than to underscore how lucky I am to have a wife who understands the rigors of a campaign? It's for this simple reason. Transportation funding is similar to a great wedding with a great wedding cake. Think of that wedding cake with several layers. Those represent the layers of funding that almost all complex transportation improvements require in order to move forward. There's often a federal layer, a state layer, regional layer, and local layers of funding, and sometimes, increasingly, private sector layers of funding as well. Let me give a couple of examples of those layers tied to specific improvements here in the Bay Area that underscore the importance of Senate Bill 1. First, the 101 corridor. Two quick examples. Caltrain. Many of us, public and private sector, have been trying to electrify the Caltrain commuter rail line for more than 2 decades. And we celebrated a milestone last year. Leslie Rogers, if you're still here, thank you for your leadership from the FTA, with $647 million in federal funds as the final layer of that beautiful wedding cake. But the 20 years preceding it built the entire $1.98 billion that were needed to bring that dream to reality. And why is the electrification of Caltrain important? Yes, it's 97% cleaner, which for those of us who are concerned about climate, pollution, and greenhouse gas emissions truly matters. It's 17% faster for those of us who are watching every moment in our go-go days here in the Bay Area. But for many of us, the true beauty is that it adds 80% more capacity. You see, Caltrain today runs with 65,000 weekday passenger trips. It is crammed to capacity in the AM and PM commutes in both directions of those commutes. With electrification, which will be done by 2022, it grows it from 65,000 weekday passenger trips to more than 110,000 weekday passenger trips. That's an 80% improvement. And when 3 out of 5 Caltrain riders are choice riders, they own a car, they're making a choice to get out of their car and onto a Caltrain car, that is transformative for the congested 101, 280, El Camino corridors, and local streets and roads. SB1 funds, announced in April and May with cap and trade funds, added nearly $165 million more to those Caltrain commuter rail improvements. Part of the wedding cake. Also at that time, at the California Transportation Commission, we were able to fund another $235 million in SB1 funds for the 101 corridor for managed lane improvements. That was matched in that cake by an unprecedented $50 million directly from private employers. Not what private employers pay through our sales tax increases and our other increases. That was writing checks totaling $50 million. Again, layer cake. The other example that I'd like to cite is something that we've been working on with leaders like Rod Dyrdon Sr. and others for several decades, and that's the improvements to extend the incredibly popular but incredibly overcrowded BART system into Silicon Valley. Layers. Local layers, 3 different countywide sales tax campaigns in 2000, 2008, and 2016 for both Segment 1, 10 miles of an extension into Santa Clara County, and Segment 2, the final 6.1 miles of an extension into Santa Clara County to connect with Caltrain, both at the appropriately named Dyrdon Station at the SAP Arena and into Santa Clara across from Santa Clara University with Caltrain commuter rail so that we finally achieve rapid rail around the entire Bay Area. But those layers are key. And in April, with Transportation Secretary Brian Annis and Transportation and Housing Senate Chairman Jim Bell, we were able to announce with SB1 funds and cap and trade funds that state layer of $730 million for Segment 2. Segment 1, let's enjoy this together. Segment 1, that first 10-mile stretch of the extension of BART into Silicon Valley, with a station in Milpitas and the North San Jose neighborhood of Berryessa, is still running $150 million under budget. Quite an achievement. One person thinks so. And that's probably my mom, so thank you, Mom. $150 million under budget, and we expect that to open between March and September of next year. Segment 2, we believe, will open by 2026. When that happens, we will again have built rapid rail around the entire Bay Area, and it will not happen without the preservation of Senate Bill 1. And this is where I get to switch hats from an advocate to a program and policy maker through the California Transportation Commission, on which I've been proud to serve these past 11 years as one of 9 gubernatorial appointees and 2 Assembly and Senate appointees. Just at our May meeting alone, we were able to allocate $2.7 billion in SB1 funds through trade corridor improvements, through the congested corridor improvements, and through the state-local partnership improvements. That totals, just in the last year, $9.2 billion allocated through Senate Bill 1 funds. 5,000 different improvements. every single one of the 58 counties that comprise California. Every city in our state but two. That is the impact and the opportunity that we have through the passage of Senate Bill 1 and its preservation. That allows the California Transportation Commission, instead of sticking fingers in the dike every year with roughly $6.1 billion in transportation funds, to nearly double that to $12 billion. And matched with federal funds that we're much more likely to get when we have a strong local, regional, state match, with that layer again of federal, state, regional, and local, we have an opportunity to have a beautiful marriage of funds at all levels of government to move our state forward. Since I hope I've made you all hungry, I'll end with one more food analogy. We have a choice. We can grow the transportation funding pie, or we can do what we have traditionally done, and that is to fight over the crumbs. It's much more successful when we grow the pie. Thank you.
Thank you to our panelists. Some light and levity with a very complicated and timely topic. Now, on to our questions, of which we have very many. First from Mike Hirsch. Question from the audience. AC transit is very accessible, yet real-time departures can be unreliable. How is the agency using technology to address this problem, and are Senate Bill 1 funds being used to that end?
Thank you so much for whoever asked that question. We know it's the number one complaint. I'm extremely excited to give you a progress report. We are replacing what we call in transportation CAD AVL, computer-aided dispatch automatic vehicle location system. We're currently running on 1998 technology. We pray every day that it continues to run. We are moving from a radio-based system to a cellular-based system. Today on AC Transit, our vehicle location is updated about every minute and a half, and we don't go much further than 9 miles an hour, but still, even at 9 miles an hour, a minute and a half, your bus can be significantly different than where the computer thinks it is. The new system will give us much greater GPS accuracy and update every 15 seconds. It's on an operating system that's supported. Credit to the board for seeing the need for this years ago. The project should be completed at the end of this year, so this one doesn't actually have SB1 funds in it. But again, those SB1 funds fund the operating of the buses. We're on what's called mini fleet right now, so 39 buses are actually out with the new system. Most excitingly, we just had buses in the Salesforce Transit Center this week and verified that the communications and GPS signals are accurate. We can actually see where the buses are inside of the Salesforce Transit Center, so that was pretty exciting for us.
Thank you. Phil, two-part question. Why does LA not have as vast a public transportation network as San Francisco? Will the city change in time for the Olympics because the sprawl is really intense?
Yes, the sprawl is intense. And let me say that, while I mentioned the speeds, keep in mind that we're competing against a whole lot of stuff on those streets, and buses are stuck in the same traffic that cars are. And one of the things that we don't like being number one in is congestion, which for the sixth straight year, I believe, the L.A. area was number one in the world in congestion. That's incredible. Wow. I think people must be reminded that we move 1.3 million people a day. And so I'm stunned that when I talk to people, they don't realize L.A. has a subway. I mean, people just don't realize that. But we have a very, very large system. I predict with all the investment that is going on over the next 15, 20 years, that we will surpass New York in the number of people that we move per day. And New York is around 6-7 million a day or something like that. I predict we will surpass New York. So this investment and this transportation revolution that is going on in LA County, I believe, will make us the transportation infrastructure center of excellence. And I think the mode share, which is right now between 7-10%, that's the amount of people that actually take transit, it's between 7-10% now. I think we're going to be at about 25% in the next 20 to 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. The second part to the question, you spoke briefly about the introduction of MICO Transit.
Yes.
Can you talk more about the rollout of that program mm-hmm. and how it becomes a solution to first and last mile challenges?
Well, I think that this MICO Transit idea, we've already brought on three firms to help with that. We have assigned them geographic locations within LA County to pilot this initiative. And so where we cannot get a 40-foot bus to navigate various streets, we think these smaller vehicles that we will use our own labor and our own drivers to actually drive these vehicles, we think that that will have a big influence on ridership. We think, and we're talking a curb-to-curb type service, we think that will address that first and last mile issue very, very well, even if it's taking people to our rail stations or, you know, around town. We think that that is really going to address some of the issues that we have, particularly with seniors as well, which we are going to specifically market to.
Excellent. Thank you. Roger, you spoke in your comments about the incredible benefit of Senate Bill 1 funding. Can you talk now about what will be the major impact without SB 1 funds if the repeal effort is in fact successful?
Absolutely, and that's the key to, I think, what we're going to have as a dialogue during the fall before the election. Through the work of every city and county in the state, the work of the California Transportation Commission of Caltrans, we have about 5,000 projects all across California. You've heard many of them described. They are everything from filling the pothole on your drive to work to major bridge and highway rehabilitation and repair and replacement. The fact is, and I think this has been mentioned this morning, there is no replacement. If this money goes away, if this $5 billion plus dollars goes away with the repeal of the funding sources that were included in SB 1, we go back to where we were. We go back to the California Transportation Commission deleting projects from the state transportation improvement program. We go back to cities and counties that have a steadily deteriorating and degrading quality to the condition of our streets and roads. And this isn't, in fact, just a reversal of going back to where we were. It actually is worse than that because, as I think most of you probably know, this deterioration occurs at a rapidly escalating rate, something approaching an exponential rate. So you find yourself, if you're a local public works director, over time, not just looking at trying to fill a pothole or do a slurry seal or an overlay, which you would have done if you had money in the normal course of maintenance, you start to stare at a replacement project in the face, which is many times more expensive generally than simply the maintenance that would have kept that condition in a state of good repair. The implications of this go, though, way beyond just the condition of our our transportation system, and it gets to some of what Michael was talking about, the jobs that won't be created, the impact on our movement of goods. Director Berman talked about the extent to which we rely on our transportation network, not just in California, but across the nation, to move goods to and from our ports, imports and exports. We start to see a real negative and detrimental impact on our economy. Our environment will be adversely affected. So there's virtually no aspect of our life in California that, and frankly beyond our borders across the country, that won't be affected if we don't succeed in defending SB 1 and we see a return to where we were in terms of funding before it passed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good. In terms of the Senate Bill 1 repeal effort, recent polls, and I'm sure many of you have read the results, suggest that up to 51% of California voters would be in favor of repealing Senate Bill 1. Now, we see that in more rural communities. Carl, can you talk to us about the positive impact of Senate Bill 1 investment in our rural communities and how they are benefiting specifically?
Great. While it is an incredible honor to serve on the California Transportation Commission for 11 years, let me tell you how depressing it is when for several years our meetings were mainly to delay, defer, or derail transportation improvements, especially in our rural areas where they rarely have the staff to equip themselves for the procedures of applying for funds, meeting those deadlines, and being successful in achieving those funds. Make no mistake, this impacts every region of our state. I mentioned how proud we were to pass Regional Measure 3 on the June 5 ballot, and we should be, but let's put this in perspective. Regional Measure 3, over the next 25 years, will generate roughly $4.5 billion critically needed dollars for 35 specific improvements with that regional layer of the wedding cake. SB 1 is $5.2 billion each and every year in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. Capture how important that is, not to just relatively prosperous Bay Area residents, but those rural residents and more suburban residents throughout our state, that without SB 1, our transportation infrastructure will continue to crumble. And as Michael Quigley adroitly noted, SB 1 is also key because it helps address, roughly 7 of every $10 collected, the aging pains of California's transportation systems. The crumbling conditions of our 50,000 state highway miles, 15,000 state bridges, the 200,000 culverts that Lori Berman mentioned, we have to protect from our aging pains. Three out of every $10 is for those growing pains. That's enhanced through efforts like Regional Measure 3, because Regional Measure 3 is almost entirely for growing pains. It takes both if we're going to succeed from a quality of life perspective, whether rural, suburban, or urban, as well as from an economic perspective.
Thank you. Michael Quigley. You talked about the increase of up to 68,000 jobs that will result from Senate Bill 1 investment. Given the impending shortage in a qualified workforce in transportation that already exists, how and where will the workers come from to fill these 68,000 jobs?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. It is one of the main implementation issues that we're going to have to deal with next year. Once we get past this, the fight this fall, is there is definitely, as we know, a worker shortage. And this is going to require a tremendous increase in the number of apprenticeship programs that the state is offering. The thing about SB 1 is that a kid who's graduating high school, say, in just this May here or June, and looking at his opportunities or her opportunities going forward in a career, maybe college isn't for everyone. They have the opportunity to enroll in an apprenticeship program out of high school. that, you know, most people don't know that apprenticeship programs require about 4,500 hours of classroom and on-the-job training. It takes about 4 years to complete. You know, once you move out of an apprenticeship and into your journeyman status, you are now a fully qualified member of the construction workforce, can work on multiple different types of projects, from road repairs to transit construction to, you know, whatever it is that you're called upon to do. And you could work your entire career off of SB1 dollars and work exclusively on those type of projects and retire with a pension and a healthcare program that would essentially give you an entree into the middle class life. And that is one of the great unsung benefits of what these sort of transportation jobs create, is that it allows us to bring back some of that social equality in terms of allowing people who aren't going to end up with a master's degree from Stanford to still find a decent job that they can support their family with, that provides them a degree of health care and retirement security that is comparable to any other private sector job. And they can do that with the implementation of SB1, you know, like I said, for their entire career. So I think that's one of the things that we'll have to communicate as we go forward in these different communities, is really what the job potential is. And it's going to be a challenge to get those workers in place. However, I do believe that the opportunity is so great and the benefits are there. And people will gravitate towards this, especially given how difficult the affordability problems are becoming in this state. These jobs are very valuable to any community because it does allow you, as I said, to close that gap of social inequality.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, if I just add on to that, actually SB1 includes $5 million a year specifically directed to workforce development and investment. So the people who, in many cases around the state, are either unemployed or underemployed, can have that bridge to what Michael's talking about, a career in the construction field or an allied field through workforce development programs and apprenticeship programs that will be the beneficiary of funding through SB1.
Excellent.
Can I add to that as well?
You may, Phil.
Because I think that is so important, this whole workforce issue. I think it is really a national emergency. Mm-hmm. With the infrastructure that needs to be built, new infrastructure, and the rebuilding of infrastructure now in this country, this is an issue that is so important. We have built what I call a career pathway in transportation infrastructure. And this career pathway is really a cradle-to-grave kind of pathway. Just this last Monday, we kicked off a transportation school, grade 6 to 12, in one of the most impoverished areas of Los Angeles. And we kicked off that school, great fanfare and everything. But the idea is, and the focus of that school is foster care kids, at-risk kids, DCFS kids, really changing the lives of these kids in these areas. And so this idea of a cradle-to-grave pathway, with the cradle being that school and the grave being the CEO position, this becomes very important.
Last comment on this question.
I'll try to be quick, but it's such an important topic. We need our community college system to respond much more quickly. Time doesn't allow us to get into the disruption and the whole automation thing, but we are, the days of maintaining a combustible engine motor engine are gone. We need to train a workforce to be able to maintain, whether it's a hydrogen fuel cell bus or a battery electric bus. The buses we're taking delivery on today have 18 computers in them, and that's only going to expand. It's no longer a mechanic with a wrench. It's now a technician position, and we have to train our incumbent workforce, but also develop the upcoming workforce to be able to maintain that highly advanced fleet.
Okay, I'm going to take the bait on this, too. So why is that community college effort so important? The 19 community colleges in the Bay Area, 272,000 students, 72% are people of color. 53% are female. We say we have a diversity problem in our workforce, especially our technology workforce, and we absolutely do. We say we have a shrinking middle class in this high-cost region, and we absolutely do. So keeping that wedding cake going, the more we can marry those 19 community colleges with each other and the offerings they have to equip these kids of color and gender diversity with our employers to train for those jobs that often only need a two-year degree or a certified course for jobs starting at $85,000 to $150,000 a year, the more that we're going to be successful as a sustainable region.
Excellent comments. Thank you for those. Now, to you in the audience, if I don't get to your question, my apologies. You can see this is a very rich dialogue, and I invite you to come up and speak with our panelists one-on-one at the conclusion of today's program. We've reached the point where we have time for one last question.
Oh.
This one has a little bit of a different flair, so I'm going to read it verbatim, and then ask you each to respond with 30 seconds or less. This program is essentially an SB1 pep rally. Can any of the panelists say anything about reforms needed to improve California's transportation governance, administration, and finance? Or, the challenging part, are you all part of the same echo chamber? Who wants to go first?
Happy to. 30 Carl, seconds, right?
You got
Start
it.
The clock.
30 seconds.
We still need a Butch and Sundance moment. I'll jump if you jump. So often folks of my party, the Democratic Party, say it's all about revenue. So often folks of the Republican Party say it's all about reform. It's both. Mm-hmm. SB1 has some of both. But we still need areas that impact transportation improvements, like CEQA reform, to continue to advance projects to be efficiently delivered and cost-effectively delivered. And we need to continue to work on that.
So I'll jump in on that real quick. I talked about how public transit is facing we're in the fight of our life, and I don't want to attack the transportation network companies Uber and Lyft, but I do want to argue about an uneven playing field. We're very proud that we are 100% accessible. We operate paratransit in conjunction with fixed route service. We do not have an even playing field today. Uber and Lyft are clogging our roads. Those operators are not safety trained annually. There's no substance abuse checking. Quite frankly, I think you're taking a risk when you get into an Uber or Lyft. There's certainly a place for them. There's certainly a place for first mile, last mile. But we would advocate that there needs to be an even playing field instead of our ridership being siphoned away and our streets being clogged.
Any other thoughts?
You know, I would say that I definitely am not part of the echo chamber. If anything, we want to create an opportunity, I think, for the public to learn that this is a different type of expenditure program. And one of the things that we, as a part of the Fix Our Roads Coalition, we were pushing for the passage of SB1 a year and a half ago, it was the actual stakeholders of the coalition who were telling the legislature, and as a condition of this bill, you have to include the lockbox. And that's why Prop 69 was included as a companion to SB1. It was because of the stakeholders like the Alliance and the League of Cities and the State Association of Counties and the building trades and everyone else who was these parts of that made up the significant members of the Fix Our Roads Coalition. This is what we were going to require in order to support the package, and including the fact that SB1 codifies the repayment schedule of the last remaining outstanding dollars from previous transportation rates. And as we also touched on, is that by 2020, all of those dollars will be paid back. The taxpayers will be whole from previous rates. And then also, as was touched on, the $100 million annually in terms of Caltrans efficiencies and also the creation of the inspector general position. You know, these were things that the advocates for SB1 were demanding as part of the SB1 deal. And that is because we don't want to see the mistakes of the past repeated.
I don't know if this answers the question, but what dawns on me is that we must capture the hearts and minds of the average person on the street to explain the benefit here. And we have to do it in a very, very clear, way and speak their language, because the average person doesn't understand the inside baseball that we talk about. And, you know, we're doing a good job of talking to ourselves, and that's great because we need to do these things, and I enjoy coming to San Francisco. You know, it's great here. But how do we capture the hearts and minds of people? The auto industry did it very well. They have pretty people and beautiful people, and your hair, not mine, but your the hair is blowing in the wind with the convertible, and they've made the automobile a sexy thing. We have to find a way to do that for public transportation.
I try not to disagree with people on stage, but I think the five of us are awful darn sexy.
I see your hair blowing in the wind.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
Beyond what's been said, I would just add two things. No, regardless of how much money you have, there are a couple things that always are pertinent to address. One is increasing the efficiency and the effectiveness of using the money we have. One way in which I think we will need to address that in the future is having a greater degree of flexibility in project delivery and management techniques and approaches. And I think the legislature is going to come back to that issue, if not next year, in succeeding years. The other is always to strive for more fairness in how we raise and spend our money. Equity and fairness are always relevant topics, again, regardless of how much money you have. That's why we're doing a road user charge pilot, to look at whether there's a more fair and equitable way of raising funding. So while it is absolutely foundational that we maintain SB1, it is not the end of the discussion. It is only the precursor to an ongoing set of conversations about how we optimize and how we maximize our resources to invest in the mobility of Californians for generations to come.
Great. Wonderful. Great answers. Thank you. Thank you to our speaker, Dr. Asha Agarwal, director of the Mineta Transportation Institute National Transportation Finance Center, to Roger Dickinson, executive director of Transportation California, Mike Hirsch, general manager of AC Transit, Michael Quigley, executive director of the California Alliance for Jobs, Phil Washington, CEO of LA Metro, and Carl Guardino, CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. Thank you for giving so generously of your time and expertise today. We are beyond grateful. And thanks also to our keynote speaker, Lori Berman, Director of the California Department of Transportation. And thanks to John Flaherty, Mineta Transportation Institute Board of Trustees, for his personal, just wonderful presence up on the stage moderating this morning's sessions. We also thank our audiences here on radio and the internet. I'm Dr. Karen Philbrick, Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute, and this concludes today's program. Thank you.